All right, everybody, it's me, Dr. Smith, and today we're going to be discussing the basically the political philosophy and ethics and theory of Adam Smith. Now, let me go ahead and say this. That is an enormous task. It is, Smith is, he only published in his lifetime two books, but they're both very big books that cover enormous, enormous swaths of territory. One is The Theory of Moral Sentiments, we'll talk about that more, of course, as well as The Wealth of Nations, which you're probably more familiar with, you've at least heard of, even if you haven't heard of Theory of Moral Sentiments. But he also was a lecturer for decades and had planned work on another book, which was going to kind of complete his triad of kind of a complete approach to ethics, politics, economics, law, etc., that he never completed before he died. And in fact, he had several volumes of writings burnt when he died that a lot of scholars kind of lament the loss of, but for whatever reason, he felt that they weren't, they didn't adequately capture his goal set. So some scholars have tried to reconstruct that kind of jurisprudential, legalistic, political element from his academic lectures and from surviving notes and stuff. So, but those are much more kind of speculative than the Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is really his kind of approach to fundamental ethics and morals and morality, and his approach to political economics, The Wealth of Nations. Now, before we get going, I want to tell you some of the resources I depended on for putting together my my kind of lecture, and that, of course, are open and available to you if you want to look them up. There's a host of things, and of course, like I drew from other stuff, these are the big ones. Jack Russell Weinstein wrote an article in the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, simply entitled Adam Smith. It's very, very good, very in-depth. Another in the Stanford Encyclopedia, or the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is an internet source as well, by Samuel Fleischacker, I believe is the right way to say that. And again, this is entitled Adam Smith's Moral and Political Philosophy. That's in the Stanford Encyclopedia. Econolib, or the Library of Economics and Liberty. Would that be properly said Econolib or Econolib? I'm not sure. They also have a wonderful article on Adam Smith. That's really kind of worth looking up. And I believe that also will link you to some free, through the Library of Economics and Liberty, you can find online copies of his complete works. Now, that leads us, of course, to the actual works that I consulted by Adam Smith. So, his Theory of Moral Sentiments, I looked at the Penguin Classics 250th anniversary edition, and I drew from the introduction essay as well, written by Amartya Sen, kind of famous philosopher. Really a good edition of that book. I also drew from two different editions of The Wealth of Nations, one which only covers the books 1 through 3, and that's a Penguin Classics version. And of course, in that, I went to, there's an analytical introduction by, oh gosh, who wrote the analytical introduction? Andrew Skinner. He also provided notes on that. I also looked at the Modern Library edition. It's a complete edition of The Wealth of Nations with an introduction by Edwin Cannon, which is very, very good, very, almost encyclopedic introduction, really wonderful introduction. Now, to give you a sense of how big these, just the texts themselves are, my copy of The Theory of Moral Sentiments, let me see here. We have, the main text is in excess of, say, 400, right around 430 pages. And you're like, wow, Dr. Smith, that's a bunch. Nay, nay, little fish. In tiny, tiny print, if we look at the main text of the complete Wealth of Nations, it comes in just over 1,000 pages. And it has a ton of notes, notes both from later editors and from Smith himself. So they're pretty gigantic works. All right, just to give you a basic timeline of his life, just to kind of center that for you, I've got some of his key dates, and we can kind of think of those. It's worth thinking about them in reference to English, American, and French history, if that's something you're particularly interested in. He was born in Kirkcaldy, Scotland, in 1723, and attended a local school, basically, until the age of either 13 or 14. I've seen both of those referenced. He started at the College of Glasgow, later Glasgow University, University of Glasgow, 1737. Later he went, after that, his education in Scotland, he went and spent some time at Oxford, and he had a very bad experience at Oxford. He came away with a very negative opinion of the quality of education in England comparative to that in Scotland. Later, he would return to Glasgow and take over at the university, first in 1751 as the chair of logic, and then later in 1752 as the chair of moral philosophy. And while he is at Glasgow teaching, he's going to publish his first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. That's going to be 1759. Later, he's going to leave, and he's going to become a tutor to the Duke of Buccleuch. I'm not sure even what language that's from. So, and he would spend a lot of time in France and Switzerland and England, and he would meet a lot of the wonderful kind of great minds, not only of the Scottish Enlightenment, but because of this, the French and English Enlightenment, including Voltaire and Rousseau, actually. So, eventually he'll retire and go back to Kirkcaldy after this, and the reason that that's possible is because he's going to be given a lifetime endowment for his work as an educator by the Duke, upon the Duke basically finishing his education, his formal education. In 1776, he's going to, and of course, if you're American, you know that that's right in the ripeness of the revolution, he's going to publish the first edition of Wealth of Nations. Now, it should be said, these two dates we've noted for the publication of Theory and Wealth, these are going to both be revised by Smith in later editions. Theory apparently is going to be revised pretty substantially up through the fifth of these six publications during his lifetime. The Wealth of Nations will be revised less, but it should be said that Smith, from what I've read, considered the Wealth of Nations the less important and lower quality of the two works, which is kind of interesting since today, if you were to ask anyone, certainly in the English-speaking world, you know, about Adam Smith, if they could name his works, Wealth of Nations is unquestionably, including for me, the one that comes to mind. he will... for a time, starting in 1778, he will serve as the Commissioner of Customs for the United Kingdom. And basically what that means is he's in charge of making sure that goods that are imported and exported are properly taxed and registered, and that smuggling is stopped. And this is very interesting when we think of him as someone who is, he's identified with laissez-faire, he's identified with... He actually has a natural sympathy with smuggling. He talks about in his works that smuggling is kind of the spontaneous, natural reaction of the society and economy to overly restrictive laws. But then he spends his last major job, basically, as an anti-smuggling commissioner. So he will serve starting in 1787, he'll be elected the Lord Rector of Glasgow University. And it should be said, he's going to be back and forth between Scotland and London throughout this time. And then he will eventually pass away in 1790. So basically, like, his academic work is largely over when he retires as tutor, other than revising and re-revising these two books he had already published, which is kind of an interesting career, quite different than how the kind of modern vision of academia with its publisher perish vision of the world. So this gets us to the beginning, right? Like, this is the starting place. Now, let me go on and warn you that part of the dilemma with Smith is he is so comprehensive in his work, in the number of subjects, that sometimes it's quite difficult to have a clear linear progression of his logic. So sometimes I'll say, now stop, let's go back and consider this thing we've already discussed and try and cross-reference everything. But it may be a little bit messy, and I'll warn you about that right now. I wish it wasn't, but so it goes. So, what do we need to say about Smith? Well, first off, his theory of moral sentiments is, again, it's really a work about ethics, and it's particularly a work about sympathy, and a work about empathy, and a work about imagination. See, the tendency is, because of our emphasis in the modern world on Wealth of Nations, is to focus, when talking about Adam Smith, on his focus on self-interest, or what he is more prone to call self-love. And that's not an irrelevant thing in his work. But he starts, and again, he regards this work as the more important of the two, he really starts by talking about sympathy. So I have a quote here. Let's see. However selfish, soever many may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. Sometimes he's going to call this fellow feeling. Sometimes he calls it sympathy, right? And ultimately what this is it's the idea that human beings, contrary to what we might think of as egoist thinkers, we'll talk about, human beings are driven by our fellow feeling, by our sympathy, by our love, our natural tendency to identify with and emotionally share interests in and with other human beings. We are not naturally at odds or naturally egoist to the point of being willing to do whatever it takes to survive. But instead, we are naturally cooperative. We're naturally sympathetic. We want to see other people happy. We don't want to see other people in pain. And this is just as natural as self-love. Now, this is the thing. I don't want to overemphasize this, because The Wealth of Nations is particularly about this idea of self-love, or it's built upon the framework of self-love or self-interest. So human beings are, absolutely, we are self-loving beings, right? We are seeking to improve our circumstances, and particularly to improve the appearance of our persons, our status, relative to other human beings, which I kind of like that. Like, riches are really a way of improving our status, which is a socio-political concept more than a economic. Though the fact that they're so deeply entwined is nothing to be sniffed at. Like, I don't think that they're readily separable. And that is not intrinsically bad. It's not bad to be self-loving. And it is also not bad to be empathetic and sympathetic and fellow-loving or fellow-feeling. So it's the key then is going to be that a productive polity, society, and economy has to find a balance between this charitable impulse and this self-interest, right? Now, let's say a little bit more about the charitable interest before we move on. One of the things that's really critical to sympathy and empathy is the process we kind of generically might call imagination, right? We are in the this when we see other human beings, we have a tendency to imagine how they're feeling. That's really what sympathy and empathy are. And so this it's kind of fascinating, right? What drives human beings to engage in rational behavior, whether it is rational cooperative, rational charitable, or rational self-interested profit-seeking, if you will, is always emotion. Emotion is the engine, if you will, that drives human behavior. And so trying to understand human beings without a grasp on the emotional character of humans is simply, it's just wrong-headed. So we do see that he is of the Enlightenment. He is part of this kind of rationalist world, but he's also part of the counter-Enlightenment, if you will, that Rousseauian vision of the world. I've got some other quotes I just think are worth reading that emphasize kind of how he thinks about sympathy and so forth. So, man has almost constant occasion for the help of his brethren, and it is in vain for him to expect from their benevolence only. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we can expect our dinner, but from their regard to their self-interest. So, when we think about this empathy and sympathy, we are prone to charity, and charity is not bad. We are, and I mean that in the broadest sense of charity, like just helping other human beings. But in the same sense, we have to be very cognizant of the fact that benevolence or charity are not going to be an adequate engine to cause a political system or an economy to continue to function. This is really, really critical, because what it infers is that we need to at least have, basically, that these emotional impulses are useful for checking each other's extremities, right? For keeping us in that realm that the Greeks called the golden mean, right? They moderate us. We may seek our own interests, but not necessarily at the expense of others. And the thing that's likely to restrain us, most of us at least, is our charity, is our fellow feeling, is our empathy and sympathy. On the other hand, we may want to help other people, but what will restrain us most of the time from doing so at our own expense is the simple self-love impulse, the fact that we are biological creatures that need, as he says, we need bread and we need beer, right? Basically, bakers and brewers, right? So we need stuff, and we're not likely to be able to get that by depending only on the charity of others. We have to work. And it is the balance of these two things that makes possible an ethical society. This leads us into two other kind of subject areas. One is this question of, are human beings egoistic then, or are we altruistic? This is something that political philosophers and theorists, we debate constantly, right? I mean, ethicists, you name it. Are human beings principally egoist, that is to say, self-interested, a la, say, Thomas Hobbes, or are we principally altruistic? Are we idealists who are able to act principally in the interests of the community, right? Or in the interests of others, doing good for the sake of good. And what Adam Smith is in essence saying is that sympathy shows us that it's not one or the other, it's both. For instance, if we remember that sympathy is about fellow feeling, it is about emoting on behalf of others, then clearly we can't call that egoism in any crisp, definitive sense. But in the same sense, because that sympathy is derived from imagination, specifically, I am imagining how others feel, and that, that informs then my behavior. I can't really call that altruistic, right? Because it's still a, it is in essence the substitution of my interpretation, my self-love, into the person of another being, which is kind of interesting, right? So it's neither egoistic nor is it altruistic in any kind of perfect, clear sense. I love that. I think that's very sophisticated. The other thing our good friend Mr. Smith likes to tell us, Professor Smith, pardon me, likes to tell us, is he points out that we need to bear in mind this concept that he uses called the impartial spectator. Right? The impartial spectator is his vision of how we can begin to parse out what is an ethical stance, an ethical policy, right? And the way we do this, and he kind of implies that this is a very natural thing for human beings to do, is we imagine that we are this person who does not have a vested interest in the action that we or others are about to take. So we imagine that there's someone outside, insofar as possible, of course, outside of the exchange or the competition or the fill in the blank, whatever kind of ethical problem it is. And that allows us to then, from the outside, judge it by standards which we might deem approximating universality, right? This is really critical because the impartial spectator is going to allow us, and insofar it clearly involves, again, imagination, it clearly involves sympathy, this impartial spectator's approach to ethics is going to allow us to avoid the problem of parochialism, which is to say our dependence on our culture or our experiences and our tendency to believe that our culture and our experiences are by their very nature universal and what is in our interest is in the interest of everyone else. It's kind of the same reason that we're prone to say it's really ideal for everyone to live a significant part of their life, months to years, outside of the place where they grew up, to go to another culture and really spend time. And spend time learning about different cultures, different economies, different polities, different religions, you name it. Because what that does is it helps you to develop a better concept of what is actually in people's interests. That are different than you. It, put it simply, in Smith's perspective, I believe, it makes it you better at imagining. It literally improves your imagination. So when you go to Russia, you know, and you spend time with Russians, and then you come back to the United States, it's much more difficult to imagine Russians are these perfectly rational, perfectly self-interested beings, or to imagine that they're perfectly emotional, perfectly like vicious or animalistic, or that they're perfectly altruistic. It makes it harder for us to stereotype. It makes it harder for us to believe that those things are true. Equally, it causes us to doubt things in our own culture and our own institutions. It causes us to engage in a process of self-questioning that is really, really critical. So we begin to question institutions that we, before we have experienced a meaningful process of education in difference that helps to expand our imagination. It helps us to better understand the prejudices and biases in our own experience. Just to give examples that he uses, for instance, the Greek culture, for the vast majority of the classical period, had an institution known as exposure. So when you have a baby and the baby is unwanted or believed to be unfit to survive, then you would expose the baby. You would literally leave the baby in nature to either die or be found by someone who chooses to raise that baby, whether it's human or divine or some other supernaturality. And this was deemed completely ethical by the Greeks, a totally appropriate thing. Smith, of course, as an Enlightenment Scotsman, is horrified by that institution. He says it's cruel and it's vicious, and the only reason the Greeks maintained it, this people whose ethical framework Smith admires quite openly, the only reason that they accept that is because they maintained a highly parochial vision of their own cultural practices, just like everybody else does. The other thing that he kind of discusses this with are institutions like slavery and racism. He really opposes racism. He ardently opposes, we'll see, colonialism. He argues that the European tendency to discriminate against, for instance, South Asians and Africans is morally repugnant. And it's only possible because of a lack of imagination, a lack of empathy, a lack of impartial spectatorism, right? And if you think about it, that's absolutely true. All prejudices are only maintainable as long as we can choose to, we can somehow make ourselves believe that the person we are prejudiced against, that we are fundamentally biased against, is somehow intrinsically different and inferior to us, that they are not so much warranting of the same ethical outcomes that we are. And that's kind of a really critical thing. Now, that's not to say that he's arguing that that all human beings are equally, that we should be giving up everything to everyone else. But it is to say that we need to be designing our institutions and choosing our behaviors and engaging in virtuous behavior that is aimed at some fundamental concept of equality. In other words, the essential human equality is intrinsic to us. And we know that if we have merely the most basic tendency to use our sympathetic imagination, right? Our fellow feeling. Now, this is kind of cool to me. What that implies then, and what he basically notes at numerous points, is that the key differences in terms of attainment of people, the most important thing in determining how much we attain economically, politically, socially, personally, in terms of our skills and so forth, it hinges not on some intractable absolute difference between us, but rather it hinges upon our relative opportunities. In other words, some of us are born with silver spoons in our mouths, and others, we're not. And our access to opportunities are much lower. And so on the average, what distinguishes how wealthy or powerful or influential an individual or a group of individuals is their relative opportunity. This I find, again, very, very interesting. It's going to play into, if you're interested in like modern anthropology, I feel like this is the underlying concept that inspires Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, for instance, which is an explanation of why some areas of the world developed earlier and were then able to engage in imperialism against other areas of the world. A really wonderful book, and there's some great articles. You can write me if you want some of those, and I'll get those to you. Okay, let's see. What is next? Okay. Let's talk about this concept of the invisible hand. You've surely heard of the invisible hand. I'm going to read a quote for you. And that'll kind of clarify exactly how Smith uses it himself. So by directing that industry in such a manner as its produce may be of greatest value, he intends only his own gain. And he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Now, the invisible hand underlines a lot of different parts of Smith's logic of the state and logic of economics and ultimately logic of society, right? What it is in essence a theory of unanticipated consequences. So human beings, when our relations are functioning ideally, when they're working the way that we like, that we want them to work, those relationships have a tendency to, in essence, be to be as beneficial or at least similarly beneficial to the community as they are to the individual who is pursuing the activity. In other words, my self-interest, my behaviors that are self-interested, should also be communally advantageous. And so therefore my selfishness, if you will, is also communally advantageous, right? That's kind of the underlying principle that will come to define the concept that we call capitalism, right? This idea that when I am investing, when I am trying to generate wealth, it is going to also lead to growth and wealth in other people's pocketbooks, and also kind of on a communal scale. It's me raising the water doesn't just raise my boat, it raises the other boats. That's the theory behind the invisible hand, ultimately. And he's not necessarily arguing that everyone is a real sweetie in this. Like, Adam Smith takes no real effort to mute his kind of distaste for the extremely rich. He is going to describe them as rapacious and as greedy. And ultimately, though, he says that when a system is designed properly, what's going to happen is that the rich, in pursuing their continued wealth, their continued increase in wealth, if a system is functioning properly, will also be improving the quality of life for the poor. Now, how does this really function? That's the key. Ultimately, the way in which the invisible hand makes this happen is through a process we call today specialization or division of labor, right? So think of it like this. If I am wealthy, then I want to make a good that will sell at the maximum profit, right? Which means I want, among other things, for the quality of that good to be very high. And so I'm likely to seek to, the more complicated the process, the more people I'm going to employ in highly specialized ways in dealing with the product, dealing with the making of certain parts, the compiling of those parts, the design of those parts, the marketing and movement and transportation of those parts, etc., as well as the moving and marketing and selling of the final thing. So the more people who are involved in specialized ways in the making of a good or providing of a service, well, then the more wealth is distributed in the selling of that good or service, if that makes sense. So in other words, what the wealthy person is doing is bringing together different factors. What are those factors? Well, Adam Smith says that the key three factors are land, labor, and capital. So land, I mean, we know what that is. Labor, well, that's literally people using their minds and hands, in essence, and sometimes their backs and legs. And then capital, what does that involve? Well, it obviously involves like the machines, it involves the special skills and the education necessary. Basically, you can think of capital as anything necessary to make a product or provide a service that is not really lumped in with labor or land. Though I think you can see that capital has a clear kind of mushiness with land and labor, at least from my perspective as just a humble political scientist. So what this means is that the rich, what their key role is in allowing for the specialization of labor to take place and therefore distribute wealth on a larger scale is the wealthy allow for innovation, and they bring together these resources of land, labor, and capital. So they are, in essence, the investors and the innovators, and then they bring together all these other classes of people who then have the ability to derive benefit from their work, from their labor. That's the broad stroke of it, if we want to be really generic. This has all sorts of implications. For instance, a good, particularly a complicated good, is, you can argue, able to give benefit to more people than an equivalent investment in charity, at least some of the time. So for instance, if I donate $5 to a shelter, that $5 may go to provide for the wages of the person managing it, or the payment of rent, or the payment of for food and electricity and other resources, medical supplies. But once they're consumed, they're pretty much gone. On the other hand, if I give that $5 to the purchase of, say, a coat or of a chair, well, all of the different people involved in the making and selling, the whole logistics chain, if you will, of that chair will derive some benefit from it. Now, I think that's an oversimplified model. It doesn't mean that charity is irrational or bad, but it is an argument for a kind of consumerist model as an ethical model. So that's a kind of intriguing element here. What else can we talk about here? There's so much. We can talk about the labor theory of value, right? So value is a real difficult thing to nail down. Like, how valuable is a good or service? Well, ultimately, Adam Smith would argue that the value of something is largely derived from... Now, it should be said, he recognizes that there are intrinsically valuable things. So, for instance, water is intrinsically valuable because if you don't have clean water, you die, right? So there's intrinsic value to some things that are undisputable. But most of the value of any kind of good or service that would be provided is provided by the labor. And we can really measure how much value is there by looking at the wages, right, that are demanded for that good, or for the making of that good, or the providing of that service, right? Wages, of course, are going to vary according to the amount of skill that was necessary to develop, to prepare, basically, to engage in that economic activity, but also from the odiousness of the activity. In other words, how kind of unpleasant it can be, right? So for instance, if we look at a medical doctor, the high wages of a medical doctor, we can argue, are largely the result of the fact that it takes enormous continuous concentration and skill, delaying of gratification, if you will, for over a decade of higher education, not including all the build-up to that moment in elementary, middle, high school, and then, of course, the ongoing process of maintaining skilled and keeping up with the technology and the advancements in the field. So that's why that kind of job would warrant high wages. On the other hand, if we look at the odious jobs, for instance, if you look at one of the examples that our friend Mr. Smith might argue is, we might say tax collectors, or we might say executioners, right? These are jobs that aren't making you friends in the community. So there has to be a compensation. These are things that have to get done. So where does the compensation come from if it's not making you friends, getting you invited to cocktail parties? You know what I mean? Well, the compensation comes from, in particular, wages, right? And those are the two things that overwhelmingly determine the value of something. That's not all that determines the value, however. Probably the most important thing that adds to the value is the question of supply and demand. Supply and demand is really critical. So our friend Mr. Smith tends to lean towards the supply side economics model. From what I've read, again, I'm not an economist, but just to keep it nice and simple and brief, we'll say that. So what does that really mean? Well, what it means is that as the supply of a good or service increases or decreases, the value of that good changes, right? We can say the same thing for demand, frankly. As the demand increases or decreases, it also affects the apparent value. But the tendency that Mr. Smith uses, he tends to not so much refer to value at this point as price. And so it makes a nice little kind of distinguisher. So value may be more about the intrinsic value versus price, which is more about like the market value, as it were, if that makes sense, right? Obviously, a lot of other things can affect price, but supply and demand are an intrinsic part of that. So water is not really worth very much on a day-to-day basis. It's relatively easy to find water, and clean water is really not that hard, particularly in a developed country, right? But if suddenly you find yourself with a bar of gold in a desert and you're dying of thirst, suddenly that bar of gold, which is a much rarer thing, which your demand, it's less important. Its value has collapsed relative to water. So it's very interesting for me. What this means is supply and demand are not only a function of literal mathematical supply and demand, but apparent or psychological supply and demand, of emotions, adding a sense of rarity. We see this right now, right? Like we're going through, as I record this, we're going through the coronavirus pandemic. And there's a real fear that certain kinds of goods will simply not be available for normal people. And this has led to buying surges, right? People are hoarding goods, which then leads to kind of a runaway effect in terms of supply and demand. And that has caused, in some places, a surge in the apparent value of these goods, which is to say the price. So labor theory of value supplemented with supply and demand. He also notes there are other things. For instance, why do we think gold and diamonds and emeralds and rubies are so valuable? Well, ultimately, part of it is simply that they're pretty. Like, literally, it comes down to that. Like, they're pretty. Other things, they're important because we've assigned cultural value to them. So value and price are a little more complicated than that, but labor theory of value is kind of at the core of his model. Let's see what else we got. Oh, but you know what? There's something I forgot before we get too much farther, but I'd like to get it in. My primary interest is international and comparative politics, as you may know. So one of the things I'm very interested in is where do the ethics that govern relations between nation states or states come from? If you think about the contractarian theories, guys like Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, right? The tendency is to think of ethics are in essence defined or even created through the process of the creation of the state, which infers that states do not have moral obligations to other states, or at least those moral obligations are profoundly limited. And equally, that there is no moral obligation to the people in other states who are members of different social contracts. So it kind of makes the question of are there universal human rights problematic. What Adam Smith will argue is that is parochialism. Our sense that our state is more important and that our ethical obligation is more important to others is really just like an artifact of the fact that we grew up in one state and not another state, that we speak one language and not another. We consider ourselves a one nation and not another, however you want to put it, right? And so if we want to engage in ethical interstate relations, whether we're talking about economics or whether we're talking about the ethics of war or the ethics of diplomacy, what that implies then is to avoid parochialism and the denial of things like what we might ultimately call universal human equality, which then leads us down the road of a universal human right concept, then we need to engage the impartial spectator principle and engage in sympathy to a point that it actually leaves the bounds of the state. So, okay, that leads us to something a little different. Sorry, I got that a little late. I apologize, but that's just how the cookie crumbles sometimes. If you saw my notes, you'd be impressed at how ordered this is. I read a lot the last couple weeks, making sure I had everything nailed down the way I wanted. I'm pretty pleased that I got as much as I did. So, what can we say about how we should evaluate any given moral decision? Well, what our friend Mr. Smith points out is that there is a difference between praise and praiseworthiness. We kind of know this, right? So, it's one thing to argue that human beings engage in praise, that we like to be praised. We like to have people say we're doing good things and we are good, right? But there's a gigantic leap between what we praise and wanting to be praised and being deserving of praise. In other words, praiseworthiness. He argues that two different things go into judging the praiseworthiness of any given decision or action. On the one hand, we could talk about the propriety of the decision or the action. In other words, does it fit into our sympathetic framework, right? Is it appropriate given our relations and our needs as humans and what we imagine are the needs of other human beings? So in other words, there's kind of an idealist element to it. What we intend is part of the dance. The other part of the dance, however, is the consequences of the action. So in other words, did it actually achieve the thing we set out for it to achieve? So we can't just be idealist, nor can we simply be Hobbesian and realist, right? We can't merely look at the consequences, nor can we only consider the intention. In truth, praiseworthiness, the ultimate ethical quality of a decision or an action, hinges upon both the intention and the consequences. It is not a one or the other, which I like that. I think that that's a deeply, a well-developed approach. He also talks quite a bit about, and this is something that we tend to talk about quite a bit with Adam Smith, which is what is the role of the state? Now, today, many people regard Adam Smith as the father of laissez-faire economics. And to a degree, I think that that's a fair assessment. Like, he does see the state as needing a restricted role. But that's not because he's necessarily against the state having any role, right? He's skeptical of the state. Be under no illusion. He constantly is kind of like denigrate, not constantly. He not infrequently talks about how politicians are vain and they're self-interested and they think that they know better than other peoples. They think they know what's better for the common person more effectively than the common person does, right? And that's, I think, pretty observable. I think the busybody attitude of people who make a life in politics is pretty common, right? And the tendency to dismiss the ability of normal people to interpret what's in their own self-interest is very, very common. Whether we're talking about people in any given ideological point, progressive versus conservative, you name it, right? But ultimately what he argues is the state does have some essential tasks that we have to bear in mind. The most important of these is it has to preserve the rule of law. We cannot, and in this, he's echoing Hobbes, he's echoing Locke, he's echoing Rousseau. The state must preserve rule of law. In other words, I have to trust my peers. I have to trust them enough to engage in economic relationships, to be able to cooperate, and so forth. And that trust is only possible if there is a neutral arbiter who will decide fairly between us, and will guarantee some level of equality to all of us in our relationships, specifically our legal relationships. That is the most critical role of the state, is to provide what we might think of as an adjudication service, a policing service, right? Right there with it is honestly that the state exists to defend us from outside actors. It exists to defend us from other states and from non-state actors outside of the state, or at least who regard themselves as not within the state society complex, who seek to hurt us or to exploit us, that have given into their egoism and parochialism and do not want to engage in trade, but want to engage in colonialism or imperialism or violence towards us, who want to take in an unfair way the products of our labor, or our good friend Mr. Locke might say, our life, our liberty, our health, and our property. He also argues that the state is critical for providing certain restrictions on banking practices. In other words, making sure that banking practices, financial practices, don't tend towards the development of monopoly. And then finally, the role of the state is to make sure that certain critical works are done which cannot be done effectively for a profit purpose, like for a profitable purpose. In other words, to make sure that stuff that we need for the economy to continue to function and for us to live securely, that can't be done for a profit, are in an ethical way, A, or B, in an effective way, are still done. Things that just have to be done to make everything else work. So among those things, he would say, that means the providing of key infrastructure, the infrastructure that is the core of trade and economics, and that means, of course, military infrastructure, that means governmental infrastructure, but it also means roads, ports. Today we'd probably include airports in that. It includes all of the, we might include today sewage, key water, things like that. Anything we would call like a utility, the state either exists to provide or to make sure it's well-regulated. The other thing that the state has a key role in is to make sure that schools exist and are available to everyone. Since the entire process of engaging in sympathetic imagination, in engaging in rational, self-interested economic behavior, as opposed to just giving in to emotions, all of these things can only happen if we are well educated. We can only escape parochialism. We can only escape the limits of our specialization, for instance, if we are well educated. And the simple truth is, while some education may be able to be done for privately quite well, the bulk of humanity has never been able to be well educated until states take up public education. And this makes sense given that our friend Adam Smith is Scottish, from a culture that makes this huge emphasis, particularly during the Enlightenment, on the broadest expanse of people receiving the maximum education possible. He also is going to argue for some different ways in which wealth needs to be redistributed. He believes in charity. He believes in some fundamental welfare things, protecting the poor, protecting the disadvantaged, protecting widows, orphans, the handicapped, the insane. He believes that all these are reasonable things, that the state has a role in playing. And this all makes sense. Now, what I find really interesting is he's going to argue that that the state is still pretty minimalistic under those terms. And I agree. What he's opposed to is the state either engaging in things like mercantilism, in which it's manipulating the economy to try to make sure as much gold and silver and other kinds of fungible wealth are held inside to manipulate trade balances on purpose and stuff like that, in order to acquire relative power, or what is perceived as relative power. He argues this is just stupid for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is wealth just sitting in a bank is not useful wealth. Wealth just sitting in a bank is dead. It's not encouraging people to work. It's not helping people to generate wealth and then distribute that wealth through market processes through the population. And so if the state is taking a proactive role in that, he's frankly opposed to it. But that's not to say he opposes all regulation. For instance, he's going to write, when the regulation, therefore, is in favor of the workman, it is always just and equitable, but sometimes otherwise when in the favor of the masters. In other words, what he believes is the state does have a role in protecting the safety of the poor and the working classes. But when we create laws which are aimed at protecting the interests of the rich, these tend to be unethical because the rich already have so many advantages over the poor that it's basically the tendency of the state is, in his mind, is rapacious, but it's not a rapaciousness stealing from the rich. It's specifically a rapaciousness of the state being used by the rich. Now, this is starting to sound almost Marxian, isn't it? I think so. And certainly it's going to inspire some Marxian thought, in my opinion. But if we think about it, it makes sense. He's going to argue that the state... See, I got another quote here. He says, the acquisition of valuable and extensive property, therefore, necessarily requires the establishment of civil government. Where there is no property, or at least none that exceeds the value of 2 or 3 days' labor, civil government is not so necessary. Civil government, he goes on, so far as it is instituted for the security of property, is in reality instituted for the defense of the rich against the poor, or of those who have some property against those who have none at all. So in other words, in Smith, the father of capitalism, in his vision, the state is at its most malfunctioning when it is a tool of the rich exclusively. But it is the fact that there are rich, and the rich, the simple truth is the rich create the state to defend their interests. So what our friend Adam Smith is afraid of is that the state is principally a mechanism for extracting wealth from the working, the poor, and the middle class. And we need to be very, very careful to design our institutions to prevent the state from remaining simply this. Now, this is also going to play into, we'll talk here in a second, about Smith's idea of the evolution of the state, where the state comes from. So remember that, put a pin in it, we'll come right back to it. You know, on this issue of the rich, I will add one other thing. I forgot I had this in my notes. And that is that Smith notes that we have a tendency to lionize and idolize and trust the rich, and particularly to trust them politically, which isn't because of their skill or because of their ethics. It's not necessarily because they're well-educated or because they're capable. But Smith notes that we are dazzled by, and his words are, baubles and trinkets. In other words, the wealthy tend to have stuff that we want, and they tend to express visually and culturally things that we admire because they have those resources at their behest. And so our tendency is to be swayed by the wealthy and to believe the wealthy even when it isn't in our own interests. And that's kind of at the core of why Smith kind of believes that the rich tend to stay in power in states, even if the rich are plutocratic. That is to say, they're running the state not for everyone, the rich included, but also for the middle class and poor, but principally for themselves. Smith also argues that there are basically four stages of the development in the development of human society, economy, and polity. And he does this, he has kind of an empirical approach. It kind of has echoes of Rousseau and the encyclopedists. I think it also it very much reflects like his perspective on the world and the moment of the Enlightenment that he's in. He argues that human beings, we have these four essential stages. One is that we have this hunter-gatherer stage, where we are principally living in unspecialized economic capacities. We do whatever work is necessary in the moment. We rarely have more wealth available to us than can be carried. Nor do we have more wealth than can be manufactured in a relatively few days' work. So the hunter-gatherer system is, in essence, in his mind, it is pre-state. That's not to say it's without politics. They're tribal politics, but he doesn't, from my reading, talk too much about those. We then see humans, in his vision of the world, emerge into a pastoral state. And Smith argues this pastoral state is, it's nomadic, right? And human beings begin to have income inequality. And that income inequality comes from the fact that there are measurable, durable forms of wealth. In other words, they last longer than a few days, and there's a lot of it. And that is in the form of animals, really, right? And this pastoral system is where we begin to see the development of state politics. But it's still highly simplified. It's relatively rudimentary. Nothing too much to write home about. Then we see the emergence of an agricultural state. And the agricultural state is where we add land into the system of wealth. And the agricultural state's also where we tend to see the income inequality kind of skyrocket, right? Because we have very durable forms of wealth that are in relatively few hands, and that allows for the control of the political system. And again, if you're looking at this, you see that the idea that the state exists for the rich is basically, it is the protection of the rich once they achieve income inequality. So the state grows and becomes more complex in response to increasing income inequality. But at the same time, that income inequality is leading to progress. The wealthy don't just want to stay as wealthy as they are, they want to become wealthier. So we're engaged in this process of technological and technical innovation. And this then has some effect on other markets, assuming that there's some level of trust and equity in the system. And then finally, we see the emergence of the commercial economies. And commercial economies are where we have high levels of variation, high levels of specialization, the largest distribution of wealth since the old hunter-gatherer days, and where we see that the highest level of urbanization is beginning to emerge. So we see money is becoming more important over time, cities are becoming more important over time, the state is becoming larger and more powerful and more important over time, and so forth. And this is also, I think, interesting because it reflects in his vision of like an urban-rural tension, right? This idea of the tension between normal people, working class people, who are freer and have more control over wealth that is more readily exchangeable into different forms of wealth in urban settings, and traditional wealth, which is in rural areas and tends to be more conservative, economically speaking, and tends to, but they still exist in a kind of interactive relationship that's mutually dependent. It's kind of an interesting kind of dynamic you see in there. So, something else I think is worth noting, actually, is Smith talks about, we already noted, he discusses the creation of commodities using those three factors of land, labor, and capital. I have another trio that I think is kind of interesting that Smith talks about, which are, there are three different ways in which we see monetary return from land, labor, and capital. So if we get a monetary return from the use of land, we normally call that rent. If we get a monetary return from our labor, we normally call those wages. And if we see a monetary return from the investment of capital, we tend to call that profit. So that's just something worth noting. That's a useful little nomenclature bit. Kind of the last thing I want to talk about, and again, if you're an economist or a political economist, like, there is so much we could talk about with Smith. You could make your whole life built on Smithian thought very easily in terms of your research. There's one more thing I'd like to talk about, though. Oh, two more things. Let's talk about two more things. One is, Smith notes that some classes are, and this makes sense given our earlier discussion, some classes in our society, some parts of our society are unproductive. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that they're not necessarily adding to the production of wealth for society. That doesn't mean that they are either unnecessary or unethical. It should be noted. So we can include in there, he includes musicians and actors and comedians as an example, as they are not productive in the sense of they're not producing, like, they're simply not producing wealth. But they're also making life worth living. The other stuff he talks about are the policing elements. So basically government, right? So our government, insofar as it is doing things like defending us, our military, for instance, all investment in it, just like all investment in dancers, I guess, is actually not adding wealth to the economy. It's not driving the expansion of wealth across classes in the same way that productive investments of wealth do. Now, again, this is Smith's perspective. I'm not sure I totally agree, but I think it's interesting. Again, that's also not to say that those unproductive classes are unnecessary. If you don't have a military, you're going to probably suffer some serious consequences. If you don't have police, you're going to suffer consequences. Productive or investment in the unproductive society, however, we should bear in mind, should be limited to a level, according to Smith, that it doesn't weigh down or undermine the ability of the productive elements of society to continue healthy functioning. So that's one of the things. The last kind of thing I'd like to talk about is the effects of the commercial spirit. See, as we go through the process of evolving into a commercial state and developing into a state which hinges on rule of law and that hinges on international trade and domestic trade and this whole concept of free trade, Smith argues that there are inevitably correlating transformations in our character, call it our culture if you prefer. For instance, he notes that commercially spirited peoples tend to be, they have high probity and punctuality. In other words, they're proper, they're formalistic, they emphasize specificity, they emphasize record keeping, they emphasize all sorts of forms of formality, and one would assume with that, I would say, bureaucratism, both corporate, let's not call it corporate because that could get messy real fast given the time, both private and public bureaucratism. But he says also because the commercial spirit tends to accompany an increase in specialization, if the state doesn't undertake real efforts to guarantee very good education, the tendency is for people to become narrow-minded and stupid, in his words. We become more parochial. We don't care about things outside of the narrow range of experiences that we have. And so we become inept at politics, inept at ethics. We don't seek out quality experiences in our lives, and we have trouble even understanding what's in our interest or even what's in the interest of other people. So the whole system of sympathy begins to fall apart. We also tend to decline in courage and in martiality. So we lose some of those, when we talk about Rousseau, what we might think of as the romantic values start to unravel as we become more commercialistic. Well, guys, this is a really, really, really basic introduction to the work of Adam Smith. I hope it's useful. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to call me or write me, email me, write me on Facebook, whatever you need to do. If you need to set up a meeting, absolutely we'll do it. So I hope you're doing well. I hope you're staying healthy and well, and I will talk to you very soon. Have a lovely day.